Dr. Michael Zimmerman, a biologist, is the founder of the Clergy Letter Project and Evolution Weekend. Over 13,000 Christian, Jewish, and Unitarian Universalist clergy have signed a letter in support of teaching evolution in public schools. On the Sunday closest to Darwin's birthday, faith communities all over the United States celebrate Evolution Weekend by honoring science and religion. Author Barbara Kingsolver lives in Southwest Virginia. She's the author of 14 books, including The Poisonwood Bible, The Lacuna, An Animal Vegetable Miracle. She visited with me at the WEHC studio at Emory and Henry College to discuss her latest novel, Flight Behavior, a novel set in southern Appalachia. In part, it's about denial and the beliefs that get assigned to us. From the archives of Progressive Spirit, progressivespirit.net, I'm John Schuck. Stay with us. You're listening to the podcast version of Progressive Spirit. If you enjoy the show, please go to iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Podomatic, TuneIn, or whatever podcast app you use to listen and give Progressive Spirit 5 stars, won't you? Contact me through progressivespirit.net with your thoughts and ideas about the show, and be sure to share this podcast on your social media. Follow on Facebook and Twitter. The website, again, is progressivespirit.net. For the Pacifica Radio Network and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, and from the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon, this is Progressive Spirit, progressivespirit.net. I'm John Schuck. In this episode, I take us back to 2012 and 2013 for a rebroadcast of interviews with Michael Zimmerman and Barbara Kingsolver. In the first part of today's show, you'll hear an interview that first aired in February 2012 with Michael Zimmerman, the founder of the Clergy Letter Project and Evolution Weekend. Over 13,000 Christian, Jewish, and Unitarian Universalist clergy have signed a letter in support of teaching evolution in public schools. On the Sunday closest to Darwin's birthday, faith communities all over the United States celebrate Evolution Weekend by honoring science and religion. Let's start with the Clergy Letter Project. You are the founder of that and the creator and the director of that. What is it, why is it, and how is it going?
Let me answer the last question first. It's going wonderfully. We have support all around the country from thousands upon thousands of religious leaders and scientists. The religious leaders cross numerous denominations, lots of religions. We started about 7 years ago because there was an ongoing attack on science education in this country, mostly coming from fundamentalist religious leaders who believed that teaching the best science had to offer, and in biology, that is evolutionary biology, was an attack on their religion. People were saying, and this goes back since the time of Darwin, but they were saying that you have to choose between science and religion. And from work I had done years and years ago, I knew that just was untrue. And there were lots of religious leaders who could speak out in favor of their religion, their deeply held religious beliefs, but they could also speak out in favor of modern science. So we called together groups of clergy members and asked Christian clergy first to sign a letter that talked about the importance of their faith to them and how it does not conflict with what modern biology teaches us. After a little bit of time, we expanded outward. We now have 3 clergy letters, one for Unitarian Universalists, one for rabbis, and actually we have a 4th for imams, but that's a relatively small group so far. And then we started an event called Evolution Weekend, in which we asked participants to do something in their congregation or with their congregation on the weekend closest to Darwin's birth, February 12th. And hundreds began to do something. And we've had people from 20 different countries and every state participate. And it's just a way to elevate the dialogue about important science and religion issues. It's to demonstrate that people do not, in fact, have to choose between the two. And it provides a great source of support for those clergy members who, before we started, thought that they were alone. They thought they were the only ones who were comfortable in both the scientific and the religious realm. And I can't tell you how many clergy members have come to me and said, wow, I didn't realize there were hundreds and thousands of others who felt like I do. It really is reaffirming to my beliefs and helps me move forward giving this good message to people.
And I believe there are about 13,000 now, is that, our clergy who have signed the letter?
Yeah, as of this morning, the Christian clergy letter has 12,780. Our rabbi letter has 482 signatures. And our UU, Unitarian Universalist clergy letter, has 244. We're being somewhat parochial. We didn't mean to be parochial, but with a small staff, me, we focus just on the United States. So all of those, and that's, what is that? That's over, that's almost 14,000 total clergy on three letters, are just from the United States. And we've had clergy from all over the country want to sign on, but for political reasons and just logistics, I've kept it to clergy in the United States. When we move to Evolution Weekend, people from all over the world have been participating.
And you said that a new letter is being formed for imams.
Exactly, because there's a similar belief among some who misunderstand what Islam is about, and some who profess and promote radical or fundamentalist Islam, and there are lots and lots of people who are imams who understand Islam very well, who are perfectly comfortable with evolution as well. So what we're trying to do is just make it clear to anybody who's willing to listen and to think that you just don't have to choose between religion, deeply held religious belief, and science.
And that is the essence of the letter that was signed by the Christian clergy?
Yeah, it is. Let me read you two or three sentences. The end. It's only a two-paragraph letter. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but the last two sentences of the first paragraph say, "Religious truth is of a different order from scientific truth. Its purpose is not to convey scientific information, but to transform hearts." Then the last couple of sentences from the second paragraph say, "To argue that God's loving plan of salvation for humanity precludes the full employment of the God-given faculty of reason is an attempt to limit God, an act of hubris. We urge school board members to preserve the integrity of the science curriculum by affirming the teaching of the theory of evolution as a core component of human knowledge. We ask that science remain science and that religion remain religion, two very different but complementary forms of truth." And, you know, the rest of the letter just fleshes out those major points. And as I said, that's the Christian clergy letter and over 12,700 Christian clergy across the United States have signed. What's been amazing to me is there are when you look at who those clergy are, some of them have just been ordained literally weeks ago. Some of them were ordained 60 years ago. Some of them are from the largest congregations, the largest cathedrals in our country, and some of them are from incredibly small rural parishes. Some of them are outrageously liberal. I mean, the conversations I've had with them have been just exciting. And some of them are remarkably conservative. They share virtually nothing in common except a deep belief in Christianity, the importance of that message, and a belief in science. It crosses generations. It crosses location. It crosses gender, it crosses race. It just means you can accept both of these things comfortably.
My guest is Dr. Michael Zimmerman, the founder and director of the Clergy Letter Project and Evolution Weekend. This is Religion for Life. I'm John Shuck. Now, those who favor teaching creationism in school claim that evolutionists, Darwinian evolutionists, are close-minded. For example, former President George Bush said that schools should teach both creationism and evolution. They use the phrase, teach the controversy. Is there a controversy?
There's a political controversy by people who want to promote a single religious view. There is absolutely no scientific controversy about the importance of evolutionary theory. Now, what's really fascinating about any science is science proceeds by disproof. Science does not proceed by proof. So if somebody tells you, we know beyond a doubt everything there is to know about evolution, they're mistaken. We don't know everything there is to know about evolution. And if you go to the scientific literature, you'll see thousands of papers published in the peer-reviewed scientific literature every year questioning, extending, and advancing our understanding of evolutionary theory. But understanding the cutting edge of a scientific discipline is different from saying there's a controversy. Extending the cutting edge of a scientific discipline is not what needs to be taught in 6th and 7th and 8th grade schools. What needs to be taught is the best we know in simplified terms so students can understand the core of what science is all about. What can I say? George Bush, but the latter, is not a scientific expert. He's not a religious expert either. And when the concept of teach the controversy came about when the predecessors of that movement were demanding that creationism be taught alongside of evolution, and the Supreme Court ruled that and federal district courts ruled that unconstitutional. That came into being when the predecessors of the creation science movement were demanding that evolution not be taught in our schools and only religious views be taught. When that was ruled unconstitutional by the Supreme Court, their strategies keep changing and evolving. So we've gone from censoring evolution to demanding that creation science be taught alongside of it, to demanding that intelligent design be taught, to demanding that just the controversy be taught and students ought to make up their own minds. We don't do that about any other topic in our school system. We teach what the experts believe is accurate. And within the scientific community, there is no doubt that evolution is the best explanation that we have.
Well, what is the difference between creation, or what is creationism, and what is the difference between creationism and intelligent design?
At one level, there is no difference in that intelligent design is a form of creationism. It's a form of creationism that's dressed up to make it look like it is something different. But the basics of intelligent design state that there is some intelligent designer, a creator, that made portions of the universe as a whole and portions of it, and perhaps portions of our body, in the form that we see them now because they are so complex. The only way to for them to have been created was to be created as we see them today. They could not have come into being more slowly through an evolutionary process. The problem with that is twofold. First, there is absolutely no evidence for that, and there is good evidence against it. And that is, many of the specifics that are used as the best examples those promoting intelligent design have offered have been studied by biologists who have now said, well, look, here's the evolutionary sequence that we can see of how this came from more simple to more complex. The second thing that's much more important is there can't be any evidence for that particular idea because in science, as I said, science proceeds by disproof. To get to the point of disproof, you have to be able to craft testable, falsifiable hypotheses. And by that, I mean you have to make a statement for which you can imagine collecting some data that would disprove your idea. Intelligent design makes absolutely no testable proofs, testable hypotheses, rather. It makes no testable statements that you could go out and gather data and say, yeah, wow, this is wrong. Evolutionary theory makes hundreds of testable statements. It just turns out that none of them have been falsified. It doesn't mean it's true. It means it's the best science has to offer right now. Now, creationism goes well beyond intelligent design. There are lots of different forms of creationism. The most extreme version that people like Ken Ham, who is the down in your area, the head of the Creation Museum in Kentucky, he believes the Earth was created 6,000 years ago. All species were created within 5 days. Dinosaurs and humans coexisted. That kind of thing is what he once taught in public schools. But intelligent design is just on the continuum of creationism. It's just a little bit further out towards the mainstream than the complete extreme, but it is on the spectrum of creationism and is nowhere near the scientific worldview.
My guest is Dr. Michael Zimmerman, founder and director of the Clergy Letter Project and Evolution Weekend. He writes often for the Huffington Post regarding issues of education and science and religion. And I want to talk about Ken Ham in just a second, but I want to ask one more thing about intelligent design. It's a rather a tricky phrase, it seems, because I know people, for example, in my own congregation who will affirm science, they will affirm what we learn from physics, they will affirm natural selection, but they might say, but you know, that's how that whole process, maybe how God designed it or something like that. But they will be totally respectful and completely of science. And so the intelligent design phrase seems to be, well, I think that's what I would be. But and as you have just explained it, it's more far more narrow than that.
Yeah, what's amazing, people who are really good at public relations have chosen really wonderful terms. We see it in political debates all the time. And people with the best public relations minds and money end up choosing phrases that people who are more ignorant and just aren't as well-versed in the topic as others gravitate towards. Intelligent design was really an intelligently created phrase because it sounds so good. Science, I believe, and I think most scientists would agree with me, science cannot prove or disprove the existence of God. The existence of a deity is outside the realm of science. Science is one of those disciplines that, you know, one of the reasons I love science as a scientist is it self-defines, it self-limits what is available to study. So is there a God? That's a personal decision. Did God create the universe using the Big Bang as a mechanism, and did he set in motion everything that leads to what we see now in through the evolutionary process? Sure, could well be. There are plenty who believe it isn't. There are even more who believe that is what happened. That's an interesting question. It's an important question, but it is not a scientific question. If you believe that, that God did that, all the power to you, but you are not professing a belief in intelligent design as the intelligent design proponents want it to be taught in public schools.
And that's part of the issue, is it's that language that continues to be fuzzy or manipulative in some
ways.
Yeah,
I think that's a great word, John, and it's purposefully manipulative, I believe.
Last year, about 100 congregations in this area in Johnson City hosted an Origins Conference, and one of the guests was Ken Ham of the Creation Museum fame and Answers in Genesis. And he said he had reached 10,000 people or something. We had about 100 come to our Evolution Sunday service, so the numbers were quite disparate. But anyway, I saw a video of him that he put on, and he's speaking to children, and it's kind of a response back and forth, and he asked them, did any animals die before Adam and Eve sinned? And all the children respond at once, no. It was kind of eerie. But it's obvious that Ham's concern is theological and a very particular view of theology at that, one that many of us who are religious do not share at all. But I wonder, what's at stake for those who embrace creationism? What do they fear science is taking away?
You know, that's a great question, and I can give you my impression, but since I am not a theologian, unlike you, I'm not the best person to answer that. But what they do believe is, or at least the way Ham explains it, and others before him have done equally good jobs, I think, of making this argument, that if you believe in the literal word of the Bible, you have to believe every single word in there. If you don't believe the Genesis story of creation, and the problem is there are two of them, but let's leave that aside for a moment. If you don't believe literally in the Genesis view of creation, there's nothing left in the Bible you can believe. If you don't believe that Jesus came back and died for your sins, what good is anything? So once you start down a scientific view of the creation of the world, evolution of species, you've given up that worldview and you have no religion left. It's a very narrow theological perspective, which leads me to what's so important about this issue. And there are three things. One is, from a religious perspective, what Ham and his followers constantly say in response to the almost 14,000 Christian clergy members who have signed the clergy letter is they're not true Christians. Mm-hmm. The only true Christians are Christians who believe what I, Ken Ham, believe. The reason this work is so important, this controversy is so important, is there's a very small but very vocal group who's trying to define religion in their own image in this country and around the world. If we allow that to happen, we will not have the pluralistic society we deserve and we want. Secondly, if we allow that to happen, we will have even more science illiteracy. We will teach virtually none of the basics of science in our public school classes. That's really critical. And then third, if we use intelligent design the way the people who are promoting intelligent design want it promoted, we are being forced to redefine the nature of science. As I said earlier, what science is so good at is limiting its field of scope to a relatively narrow piece of the human condition, only areas for which they can make falsifiable predictions. What intelligent design people and creationists want is to incorporate the supernatural into the realm of science. So if you do that, science falls apart because any answer that you give to any question scientifically can always be, God did it this way. And even if that's an accurate answer, it's not a scientific answer. So those are the three reasons this battle, I think, is so important.
And from my perspective as a religious person, I think religious literacy is important, and it seems to trivialize these very narrow views, trivialize religion into almost superstition rather than being the depth and breadth that religion can be for the human condition and in helping to people cope with life.
Absolutely. You've said that so nicely. Can't disagree with a word you've said.
I'm speaking with Michael Zimmerman, creator of the director of the Clergy Letter Project and Evolution Weekend, writes at Huffington Post, and you've received quite a bit of pushback with your work there. Some of your posts have 500 comments or more, and the pushback does not often just come from creationists, but sometimes some atheists. What is their complaint?
Yeah, you know, it's probably half of my hate mail is from the atheist group, not all atheists, obviously, but the group calling themselves New Atheists. And there's a group of them who I like to term, and I'm not alone in saying this, they are fundamentalist atheists. They are proselytizing atheists. I mean, they literally are of the sort of fundamentalist religious leaders and fundamentalist religious proponents who believe that their way is the only way. And they, metaphorically, go around knocking on doors, passing out pamphlets, and saying, you have to believe what I believe. And because what I write, I don't take a religious perspective. What I take in everything that I write is a respect for broad-based religion, deeply felt religion that accepts science. I am not a fan of religion that makes claims about the natural world. I don't believe we see miracles before us today. Religious leaders who claim non-naturalistic events have to accede to science when science demonstrates that could not happen as we see it today. Mm-hmm. But these new atheists are claiming that as long as you give any credence, any support, any respect to religion in any form, you're doing great damage to society. And frankly, I think that's an extreme view that is doing damage to some of the things they care about, which is science literacy, just like I care. And I think it's so incredibly disrespectful for the majority of people in this country and in the world.
I think the very fact is that whether or not we like religion is going to be with us for a while. Rather than end it, we might mend it.
Wow, nice way of putting it. Now I understand why you're the host, and I'm just somebody who's talking with you.
You have done an incredibly important work for scientific literacy. And I want to talk one thing you put on one of your posts was kind of interesting, a little politics here. You said, is Rick Perry smarter than a fifth grader? Not when it comes to science. So what's your grade of the Republican candidates regarding questions of science?
I haven't seen, other than John Huntsman, who gave a quick tweet a while back claiming that, yes, he accepts evolution, and he also accepts human anthropogenic, global climate changes. I haven't seen anybody who is willing to speak in a way consistent with the scientific consensus. I am unwilling to say most of those people believe what they're saying. I don't know if that's worse or better. I believe right. most of those people are smart enough to know what the scientific community is saying. They are just unwilling to say that. Even Huntsman has backed away from climate change because it wasn't popular enough for him. And it's just, you know, it's
politics
it's pandering.
As usual.
It's politics and pandering as usual, exactly. And to be honest, there are many Democrats who do the same thing, and it's a shame.
My guest is Dr. Michael Zimmerman, author of the book Science, Non-Science, and Nonsense, Approaching Environmental Literacy, founder and director of the Clergy Letter Project and Evolution Weekend. We're just nearing our end of time, but I wanted to ask a final question. It's difficult for me to know if scientific literacy is making progress. Overall, what do you think?
I think in the world it is, and I think in the United States we're losing ground.
Really?
Yeah, unfortunately. I think a lot of the Pacific Rim countries are doing far, far better job of teaching what science is about. And from my perspective as a science educator, I don't think it's about science facts. I think it's about understanding the difference between science and non-science to make sure that we have a society that can differentiate between scientific ideas and ideas that sound scientific but truly are pseudoscientific. Because we're scared of things like evolution as a society, we're scared of its implications because of some loud voices, we don't teach how to make those differentiations. And we're spending a ton of money on pseudo-medicines that do nothing to help people except put money into the pockets of the purveyors of those medicines. The list goes on and on about pseudoscientific ways we spend our money and make policy. When you look around at patents coming out of the United States versus the rest of the world, our primacy is declining. When you look at the number of scientific manuscripts published in the United States and the rest of the world, our leadership there is declining. So I'm depressed about what we're doing with science education and science literacy in this country. I think the human condition might be okay, because the rest of humankind, not all of it but much of it, is improving in this regard. But what a shame for the United States to lose its primary role and its starred position. And we're doing it to ourselves, and there's no reason for it.
Well, thank you for your work in scientific literacy and for the Clergy Letter Project in encouraging clergy to do their work for religious literacy.
And thank you, John. You have a wonderful show, and you speak up and speak out so well and articulately. We need more people like you as well.
Dr. Michael Zimmerman, thank you for being with me today.
My pleasure. So long.
You've been listening to a 2012 interview with Michael Zimmerman, founder of the Clergy Letter Project and Evolution Weekend. You're listening to Progressive Spirit. I'm John Schack. An interview with Barbara Kingsolver is next. Stay with us. Progressive Spirit is produced every week. It couldn't happen without the financial support of my congregation, Southminster Presbyterian Church in Beaverton, Oregon. Southminster's website is www.southmin.org. Progressive Spirit is produced in the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon, for the Pacifica Radio Network, and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, as well as podcast. Show KBOO some love, won't you? KBOO.fm, and click donate. This is Progressive Spirit, progressivespirit.net. I'm John Schack. This episode contains interviews that were originally broadcast in 2012 and 2013 when the show was called Religion for Life. In March 2013, I broadcast an interview with Barbara Kingsolver. Barbara Kingsolver lives in Southwest Virginia. She's the author of a number of books, including The Poisonwood Bible, The Lacuna, and Animal Vegetable Miracle. She visited with me in the studios of WEHC on the campus of Emory and Henry College in Emory, Virginia, to discuss her novel Flight Behavior, a novel set in southern Appalachia. In part, it's about denial and the beliefs that get assigned to us. My guest is author Barbara Kingsolver, and she is in the studio with me. And the studio is WEHC on the campus of Emory and Henry College in Emory, Virginia. Welcome, Ms. Kingsolver, to Religion for Life.
Thanks. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, I am so glad you're here, and you just live right down the road a piece, don't you?
A stone's throw from here, yep.
And you've lived here for a little while? You were here for a few years?
I've lived here full-time since 2004. Before that, I spent summers here and the school year in Tucson, Arizona. We did that for about 7 years. We moved back and forth with the kids, but really ultimately wanted to be here. So here we are. And this is home for me. It feels very much like home. I grew up just on the other side of the mountains in eastern Kentucky. So this is the culture of my childhood.
And you talk a little bit about your life and the move from Arizona back here in animal, vegetable, mineral.
We did write about that move. It's true. From city to country.
And making country life really living locally as much as you could.
Right. That book was about, it was really a book about food systems and local economies. It wasn't really a book about us, but we sort of posed it as a book about us to make it interesting.
And Barbara Kingsolver, again, my guest, she's the author of at least 14 books that I saw on your website, kingsolver.com, The Bean Trees, The Poisonwood Bible, which was a finalist for a Pulitzer Prize, Animal Vegetable Miracle that we talked about, and her latest book is Flight Behavior. And the setting for Flight Behavior is somewhere around here, Feathertown. I believe it's Tennessee, but I'm not sure.
It's never exactly identified, and I do that intentionally so that it's, I don't want some actual little town to become a tourist destination or what have you. But the sense of it is Southern Appalachia, this region. It could be Tennessee, it could be Virginia, but Knoxville is the largest city nearby. That's where people go for their shopping and so forth. So yeah, it's these mountains, it's this region. It could be any little town around here, to tell you the truth. Yeah.
Now, can you give us just a quick setup for the book?
This is a book about denial, really. That's how I think of it. It's set on a farm. The protagonist is a young woman named Della Robbia Turnbow, who had maybe big ideas, big dreams in her life, but became pregnant in high school, married very young, and has really settled for a life that doesn't make her happy. She's kind of trapped living with her husband and small children and in-laws on their farm, domestic unhappiness. She has never quite given up on her dreams, but she's about to because she doesn't know what her dreams really are. One day, just kind of at the end of her rope, she's decided to do something very wrong. She's marching up the mountain behind her house to meet a younger man. She's about to initiate an affair, which she knows will wreck her life. The opening line of this book says, "A certain feeling comes from throwing your good life away, and it is one part rapture." She knows that she's doing something abominable, and she can't help it. It just feels like she can't stop herself. Well, on the way up the mountain, she is stopped by an amazing sight. She sees what she thinks is the whole forest on fire, but there's no fire, there's no smoke. She decides it's some strange kind of miracle. Turns tail, marches downhill to try to get her life in order. And the novel proceeds from there. What she has seen, I'm not going to tell you what it is, except to say that it isn't... what she has seen is an extraordinary biological event. It's a sort of freakish biological event that is really a disaster. But the people in this little town... in the main, think it's a miracle. And so the promise of that first sentence becomes what this book is really about. A certain feeling comes from throwing your good life away, we know we're making huge mistakes. It turns out that this shocking biological event is probably the result of climate change. And so the novel sort of draws us all into that big mistake we're making and the fact that we sort of can't help ourselves and why it's so difficult to talk about climate change and its consequences and why can we really not see what we're seeing. How's that for a setup?
That's a great setup. That's a great setup. So what kind of research did you need to do for flight behavior?
A lot of research. This the biological event is, it turns out to be, it's something that actually happens somewhere in the world, just not here. So I of course, took a trip to see that, and it does look like a miracle. I can tell you that. It's one of the biological wonders of the world. So there was some travel involved. A lot of reading, because I read about this biological system that's described in the book. And what happens in the novel is that scientists come in from the outside to study what's going on here and why. Why has this whole system been thrown out of whack by a changing climate? The local people are sort of look askance at the outsiders. The media get involved, of course. Tourists come from everywhere. And so I had to sort of learn about all of those factions. And I wanted to get my science straight. And important characters in this novel are scientists. So I spent time with that type of scientist and, you know, spent time in their labs to see what sort of equipment they use and read their research. So I wanted to be really knowledgeable about this system because even though it's not something that has happened, it is something that could happen as a result of climate change.
And in the course of the novel, I learned a lot about this biological system, and I learned it in a way where it wasn't. I was just going to school. It was beautifully done, and it wove. The system wove also with the main character's own flight behavior, of her own personality.
Right, her own attempts at flying away. It's about all kinds of flight behavior. This novel, the fact that all of us would rather run away from our problems than to face them. The fact that it's very much easier to fly from pillar to post, as one character puts it, than to settle down and dig in and do one thing well. And it is about the flight of this mysterious creature that we're implying but not saying outright.
My guest, if you're just joining us on Religion for Life, is author Barbara Kingsolver. She's the author of over 14 books, from fiction to collections of essays. And her latest book is Flight Behavior. And it has to do with climate change. And you acknowledge in the work and the acknowledgments the work of Bill McKibben and his book Earth, that he spells with two E's. He's saying that he needs to spell Earth differently to show that we're on a different planet, in a sense. According to McKibben, climate change has really moved us beyond the point of no return. And one of the characters in your book, the scientist, Ovid, has a rant with a television reporter, and he says, quote, "The glaciers that keep Asia's watersheds in business are going right away. The Arctic is genuinely collapsing. Scientists used to call these things the canary in the mine. What they say now is the canary is dead." And so my question, Barbara, is, is Ovid exaggerating, do you think, or is the canary dead?
Well, the first canary is surely dead. I mean, the canary that might have warned us that we're headed somewhere that we don't want to be is long dead. As a matter of fact, we've known about the potential for climate change for over 100 years. When I say we, I mean not me. Scientists who study these things. And climate scientists have been warning us about severe about their severe concerns for 30 years, as you know. So that canary has sung its song. Now, I want to go back to the novel and say this quote that you read, of course, it's like 300 pages in. So a reader should not expect to be lambasted by this novel. This novel is really about people and how we learn, how we refuse to learn, how we talk to each other about difficult problems. Mm-hmm. So this is some of the things that happen in this novel are that people fail to communicate very well, and that was an example. This scientist is being interviewed by a TV personality who really won't ask the right questions. She keeps kind of skirting and denying what he's saying until he just has to kind of explode, and she runs away. And one of the spectators has gotten it all on her phone, so she posts it on YouTube. Uh-huh. It's about the many different ways that we communicate, both expressly and accidentally, and some of the reasons for our special difficulty around climate change, talking about climate change, why it is that we can all look at the same set of facts. We can look at evidence that, as I said, has been amassed for easily 30 years and longer, and still not agree on what we're seeing. That's what interests me as a novelist, not truth or dare, you know, not do you or don't you believe, but how do we choose to believe? And faith is an important part of this novel, too. This novel is about walking the line between faith and reason, between conviction and doubt. The church is a very important part of this novel, which I presume is why I'm here.
Well, the church and the church presented in the novel is actually very concerned about Earth, and it isn't. Sometimes we might have a stereotypical view of the church as not concerned, perhaps, mm-hmm. about things that are regarding Earth and that type of care. It ends up having oftentimes conservative politics attached to it. Mm-hmm. But all, as with all of the characters in your book, there's no stereotype in them. They are deep characters. From a variety of perspectives.
They're characters who are, like the people I know, mm-hmm. very complicated,
yeah.
full of contradictions, full of surprises. That's what makes a character interesting and believable, I think. And I, when I undertook this novel, I really wanted to explore the culture where I live, Appalachia. But I also wanted to explode some stereotypes. And one of the ways that I really enjoyed doing that, and this is another area of research, the church that these characters attend is it's a kind of a megachurch. It's kind of what people call Six Flags Over Jesus. It's kind of one of those churches. Uh-huh. That has its, you know, it has its like the cafe in Christ where you can get your coffee and donut and watch the minister on the screen, or it has the men's fellowship where the guys go and smoke and listen to country music and the kind of turn down the sermon, and as well as the sanctuary and so forth. And I thought readers from outside of this region will begin by thinking these people are a bunch of puppets who are being told what to believe and who are just sort of, I don't know, ditto heads or whatever. But they're not. They're interesting people. They're thoughtful people. And this minister is, he's a very typical minister of this region, I think. He's very personable. He tells stories. He kind of serves as a counselor for his, mm-hmm. for his congregation. And he also is very concerned about God's creation. He feels that the work of the Lord should not be carelessly destroyed. So there's complexity. And there are also a lot of secrets. Everybody in this novel has secrets. Everybody in this novel is connected to the story in some way that will surprise you. So I felt that was a very I wanted to bring in people of faith to balance the scientists as sort of all part of this community of decision making and processing the information involved.
Barbara Kingsolver is my guest on Religion for Life. She's the author of a new novel set in southern Appalachia called Flight Behavior. And one of my favorite scenes, it's also near the end, but it's when up on the mountain and this biological event is happening and an environmental activist is handing out flyers about, I guess, how we can reduce our carbon footprint.
Mm-hmm.
And Della Robbia asks him finally to read his list. And none of the things on his list of to-do lists or not to do or things that she would be able to do anyway for economic reasons.
Right,
you know,
eat less red meat. And she says, I wish that I could eat red meat. And he says, take your own cutlery to the restaurant. And she says, I haven't been to a restaurant in 2 years. He says, turn down the heat. We're trying to keep the heat on. I really wanted to develop the complexity even in these environmental arguments and point out that class is an important component mm-hmm. of all these conversations, and that it is in some sense a privilege to have the option of reducing your footprint, something that isn't much talked about. There are a lot of layers here to be addressed, and also a lot of conversations to have about why we believe what we believe based on not just the information we have, but the circles and the communities that surround us and the people who we feel to be looking out after our own. We don't always even get to choose what we're going to believe in, at least to begin with.
There's a section, and I was wondering if you would read that. Near the end, we talk about the media missing the real story, but also this territorial divide of the sides that seem to be forced upon people.
Right. The reasons people believe as they do. This mm-hmm. conversation takes place between Ovid Byron, the scientist, a Harvard-educated who has come in to study this problem, and Della Robbia, the protagonist, who is from here, the farm wife. And Ovid is a little baffled and a little frustrated at why local people don't believe in climate change. And he says, It didn't used to be this way. 15 years ago, he says, people knew about global warming, at least in a general way. Conservatives or liberals saw it exactly the same way, and now there's a divide. Della Robbia says, well, yeah, people sort themselves out. Like kids in a family, you know. They have to stake out their different territories. The teacher's pet or the rascal. She says, I'd say the teams get picked, and then the beliefs get handed around. Team Camo, we get the right to bear arms and John Deere and the canning jars and tough love and taking care of our own. The other side wears, I don't know what, something expensive. They get recycling and population control and lattes and as many second chances as anybody wants. Your students emailing you to tell you they deserve their A's. Ovid looked stupefied. What? You're saying this is some kind of contest between the peasant class and the gentry? She returned his look. I definitely don't think I said that. Something like it, he said. One of your teams has all the skills for breaking the frontier, and the other seems to be nursing a restive society that grows in the wake of the plow. Huh, she said. But would you not agree the frontiers of this world are already broken? I guess, maybe. Well, if it's true what you're saying, that this whole crapload is going to blow, then what, we start over? Ovid said nothing. She knew she'd crossed a line of disrespect, putting it that way. This was like church to him, or children, the thing that kept him awake at night. Sorry, she said, I'm just saying. The environment got assigned to the other team. Worries like that are not for people like us. So says my husband.
Hmm. And yet she is the one, Della Robbia, who really is a heroine in the sense that she's able to cross that communication divide.
She has far to go. That's right. A good protagonist is one who has far to go. And she crosses a lot of ground in this novel. And that's, I think, one of the wonderful things a novel can do for a reader is take you through a journey of self-examination, of exploring new worlds and coming out the other side.
You are also personally involved in certain activist aspects. For example, I want to thank you on behalf of myself and my congregation for lending your voice regarding mountaintop removal. I know that you and Kathy Matea did A View from the Mountaintop in 2012 in Knoxville. And I wonder, is there a lesson from flight behavior for those of us who are active, perhaps, for Earth or something like that, and it seems that we keep spinning our wheels?
Oh, I don't think any of us are spinning our wheels.
We
maybe it feels like that, but my favorite thing to remember is that Dr. Martin Luther King told us the arc of history is long and progress is sure. Sometimes progress is so slow we don't see it happening. I wouldn't ever presume to say what a person should take away from this novel, what lesson they might learn from it, because for every reader it's different, you know. Mm-hmm. I think, and that's another thing I really love about literary fiction, is that what you receive from it depends entirely on what you bring to it and what you need. It supplies many different kinds of nutrient for many different kinds of minds. So it isn't one size fits all, but I hope that this novel will invite readers to have a conversation with themselves about what they believe in this world, why they believe it, and how they hope to proceed.
Yeah, I found it very hopeful in many ways, hopeful of the, even as it was put, with these divisions between people, hopeful that we might be able to listen to one another and hear the other concerns, especially that division that you talked about regarding class.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, the one thing we can be sure about is that calling the other side stupid and throwing rocks over the wall is getting us nowhere. So that, I suppose, is really my point of origin for this novel. What better way to begin than by really understanding that everyone in every argument, on every side of every argument, believes he or she is right. That's the novelist's point of view. We have to believe in all of our characters. Then we put together their conflicts and see what rises up.
Barbara Kingsolver has been my guest on Religion for Life, and do pick up her latest novel, Flight Behavior. And thank you for being with me today.
You're very welcome.
You've been listening to a special encore presentation of Progressive Spirit, featuring interviews from 2012 and 2013, when the show was called Religion for Life. Catch over 300 interviews with scholars, activists, and authors who have something to say about social justice, spirituality, and human flourishing on progressivespirit.net. For the Pacifica Radio Network, PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, and KBOO in Portland, Oregon, I'm John Schuck. Be well.